Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
To begin today's program, we're going to talk about hospital visits. Never a treat, but overall they can be a positive experience, especially if we recover. And hospital visits become more and more likely as we progress through our middle years. So we might as well make the best of them and prepare for them. Do you or a loved one have plans to visit a local hospital anytime soon? Oftentimes we don't make advance plans, of course. We suffer an unexpected emergency. But even if it's for a routine operation or procedure, anyone admitted to the hospital, including you and me, faces inevitable stress and anxiety. And often a hospital visit is accompanied by severe pain, trauma, and physical distress. Add to that a mix of a bombardment of information and instructions from a sea of strangers, and it's very easy to get overwhelmed. And the exchange of crucial information between you and your healthcare team members and your loved ones upon admittance and throughout your hospital stay carries a heightened responsibility when it's combined with the urgency of your well-being, of course. And all parties involved must be attentive to giving and receiving timely, accurate information. After all, you all are a team, and information sharing can be a life and death matter. Granted, hospitals are busy places where staff must juggle heavy workloads and constant interruptions, but any confusion, omission, or miscommunication can have disastrous consequences because a recent report from a patient safety group found that communication breakdowns led to 1,700 patient deaths over 5 years, and we certainly don't want that to happen to you or a loved one. And my guest today is a certified nurse and author. Her name is Katie Kleber, and she's here with practical tips to guide you through your next hospital visit, vital information to provide who will be taking care of you, the degree of attention you will receive, and how ultimately you will be released to go home, the most important thing. And Katie Kleber is a BSN, RN, and CCRN, a nationally certified critical care nurse in the Neurosciences Intensive Care Unit at Novant Health Presbyterian Hospital Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. She has a new book called Admit One, What You Must Know When You're Going to the Hospital But No One Actually Tells You. I love that title. Providing an insider's guide to hospital culture and what to expect. And she's a veteran author and blogger on top nursing trends, recognized by the Charlotte Business Journal as 2015 Nurse of the Year, and also a recipient of the Great 100 Nurses of North Carolina Award. And she's appeared on national media outlets, including CNN, The Dr. Oz Show, and The Today Show. And welcome, Katie Kleber. It's indeed an honor to have you on Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you have a section in your book that identifies what the various healthcare designations stand for. Will you please start by telling us what your three designations, BSN, RN, and CCRN, stand for? What do you do to earn these designations?
So, an RN, registered nurse. I went to nursing school and took the SAT for nursing boards and passed that, so that's my registered nurse.
Yeah.
BSN means I have a bachelor's of science in nursing.
So
nurses can have a 2-year associate's degree or a bachelor's degree, so that's how you differentiate.
And what would a 2-year degree, it's ADN, is that what they designate?
That is correct, yep. Yeah. That's the 2-year, typically at a community college. They're actually, the Institute of Medicine did do this recommendation that 80% of nurses are bachelor's prepared by the year of 2020.
Oh.
So there's this big push for nurses to become more nurses to become bachelor's prepared because studies show they have better outcomes.
Oh, I see.
And then
what's
the CCRN?
The CCRN?
Yeah. So nurses, once they've practiced in a specific area for a certain amount of time, typically 2 years or more, you can sit to take a certification exam, which means you're certified in your field.
Yeah.
So I'm certified. I did that in 2015. So I took a certification exam over critical care patients. So that's what the CCRN stands for.
I get it. When you're in the hospital, what is your nurse's top priority? Sometimes it seems like the nurse's priority is in total conflict with the patient. Like you want to go to sleep and the nurse wakes you up to take a pill or to take your blood pressure, or you want to go to the restroom and your nurse insists on walking you to the bathroom.
Yes. So our top priority all the time is safety.
I see.
So that's why we're making you wait till we get in there to walk you to the bathroom, and why we're sitting there in the bathroom with you sometimes, because we don't want people to fall. A lot of, like me in the neuro ICU, I'm frequently waking patients up in the middle of the night to do a neurological assessment of them to make sure their brain is not changing. Again, they don't like me because I'm waking them up, but their safety is my priority.
Well, what are the primary responsibility of you nurses while we're in the hospital? I guess you sort of covered that.
So nurses, the role of the nurse has really evolved a lot over the years. And currently, you know, it's more than just passing meds and making beds.
Yeah.
We're passing medications, but we're also making sure they're all appropriate. And we're coordinating everything with the healthcare team, you know, the physical therapist, occupational therapist, the doctor comes to touch base with us. We're coordinating everything within your care during that stay and making sure everything that needs to be done and all the everything is taken care of for you. And that includes dealing with a lot of really technological equipment.
Yeah.
That's very advanced and very, a lot of it's pretty difficult to learn how to use and stay on top of. And as many people know, technology is continuing to advance, and we're the ones that are providing care and have to learn how to use all that stuff.
You also have to do all the documentation, though. I know I see nurses in the station sitting there with their computers a lot.
Oh, man, every little thing a nurse does. We have to document that we did it, or else it's not done. So if I walk in the room to just see how you're doing, I have to go chart that I did that.
I see. Well, let's say that I'm experiencing discomfort in my leg or wherever, and I recently asked you for pain medication, but the nurse replied that she or he can't do anything until they have the order. What does that mean?
Yeah, so actually I've had a few people say, what are orders and what does that mean? And to us in nurse world, that's one of the things we deal with all the time, and we forget that people don't know what they are. So basically, short from very, very few things, I can't really do anything without a physician's order that says it is safe to do this. Again, going back to safety.
That's a legal issue, I guess, as well as the medical.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's like the doctor will say if you can eat, and what you can eat, when you can eat, if you can get out of bed, all this stuff. But a big thing is medications.
Yeah.
So if you say, hey, my leg hurts, and you have no pain medications ordered, there's none that are on there, I can't just go grab you a Tylenol. I have to go call the doctor, make sure it's okay, find out the dose, the route, and everything, put it in the computer. Then the pharmacist has to look it up and make sure it's okay and safe, and then they give me the okay, and then I have to wait for the medication, and then I have to give it.
So I guess you shouldn't wait until you're in excruciating pain to tell your nurse that you need some medication.
Yeah, that's actually something I do find myself educating patients on frequently is, you know, if you wait until it's an emergency and you can't stand it anymore, hopefully I have medication that I can give you readily available, but a lot of times I don't if this is the first time you're reporting pain. So I have to go through that process, which on a good day takes at least half an hour. Then I got to give you the med, which takes half an hour to kick in anyway.
Well, when you're in the hospital, you're likely to hear the term attending physician. What does that term mean, and who is this doctor, and how is this physician selected?
Yes, so that's something that, as a brand new nurse, took me a little while to figure that out, too. So when you, let's say you're in the emergency department, and the doctor says, hey, and you had a heart attack, and the doctor says, hey, I'm going to admit you to the hospital. Your attending physician is the one that that emergency department doctor talks to, and you, this person is going to assume your care. They're going to be in charge of, they're the main person.
Yeah.
But let's say you have something else going on, and maybe, you know, you need, maybe you also later during your stay have a stroke.
Cool.
Then the cardiologist will consult the neurologist or someone else, like another, a doctor of another specialty.
Yeah.
So the attending person is the main person in charge, the main doctor in charge, and depending upon what's going on with you clinically, they may consult physicians from other service lines. So you have all these doctors that are experts within their field. So a neurologist expert with a brain, you know, cardiologist heart. And actually in the book, because I think this is so important, I actually outlined what all the names of all the different kinds of physicians are.
If I go in for surgery, is the surgeon, is that generally he automatically becomes, or she becomes, the attending physician, or is that not always the case?
It is probably 9 times out of 10 that's the case. And so if you go in for a scheduled surgery, that person will be the attending. But the only time that really changes if afterwards you have so many complications and you're there for a while and then the surgery is no longer the primary problem, something else is, that may be a time when it changes. But for the most part, your surgeon will be your attending.
Well, if you're being admitted to the hospital by other than through emergency, what are the most important pieces of information you should bring along with you? What are they going to ask you for?
Well,
insurance card.
Yeah. Well, the big one that the admitting nurse is going to ask you is what medications you're on what medications you've taken today.
Yeah.
So if you don't know those off the top of your head or someone else can't articulate that for you, it's great to have that written down. My favorite thing is when I ask a patient for that, they pull out their wallet, they hand me a little card, and I know exactly what they're taking, and they can tell me what they took today. So that's really important thing. If you have a living will or advanced directives, those are really important to bring if they're not already on file at the hospital that you're going to.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little more about those in a little bit because I wanted to ask you about that. But let's say that the attending physician was here this morning and the patient, forgot to ask him or her an important question. How do I get in touch with the doctor later? You never can seem to be able to find them then. So what do you do?
Oh, man. I relate to that struggle too, because the nurses, whenever the doctor rounds, they make sure to touch base because they have questions, and then they leave and then they go see all their other patients.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people assume that maybe the doctor is hanging out in an office nearby seeing other patients on the unit, and that's typically not the case. They typically come see you and maybe any other patients on that unit, and then they're going to another unit or maybe another building.
Yeah.
So if you forget to ask a question, you got to let the nurse know, and what the process would be is the nurse will page that physician, and the physician will get back to call back, and hopefully it's soon, but if they're in a procedure, if they're talking to another family, we may be waiting a little while.
Yeah, that's, I see. Yeah, so you better.
Yeah, so it can be a process.
Yeah. Well, is it once you're in the hospital, there are 3 levels of care. Just for information, what are the 3 levels?
There's the emergency department where you come in and we're checking you out and seeing if you can go home or if you need to be brought into the hospital or brought admitted. So the highest level of care is where I work. The critical care unit, that's where the patients are the most unstable and the sickest.
Is that the same as intensive care?
Yes, intensive care and critical care, same thing.
Yeah.
And depending upon the size of the hospital, you may have specialized critical care units.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I work in a neurocritical care, so I have patients that are unstable and neurologically unstable, but there's also cardiac intensive care, trauma, ICUs. But if you're, many hospitals maybe just have a general ICU intensive care unit.
Mm-hmm. And say graduate out of that, hopefully, and what's the next stage after that?
So typically when you're in the ICU and they say, hey, you're well enough to get out of the ICU, which we look to do as soon as possible.
Yeah.
As soon as you're medically stable to get out of there, we get you out of there because patients do better with shorter stays in the ICU.
Nice.
So we'll send you to the floor, and that is a general nursing floor. You're going to still receive continual nursing care, but the nurse that is caring for you is going to be caring for more patients. So in the ICU, I'm taking care of one or two patients, maybe three. In the on the floor, you can they can be taking care of anywhere from 4 to 7, 8, 9 patients.
Oh, I see.
So you have a lot more independence, a lot less beeps and buzzes. You're checked on less frequently, but that we're still there taking care of you. But there also is this middle step that maybe a patient is not sick enough to be in the ICU but not well enough to be on the floor. It's called an intermediate care or sometimes a step-down unit.
I see.
Not patients, that one's not routinely, people don't routinely go there. It's kind of, you know, very situational. So, you know, if you kind of fall in the in-between, because we want to have a place where we can watch people a little bit closer than the floor, but not quite as close as the ICU. So it's kind of like a middle ground.
Well, let's say you're in a hospital room with an IV in your arm. You notice that the tube is dislodged and that your sheets are wet with liquid. No nurses around. To save time, should you attempt to reconnect the tube?
No, absolutely not. Let those sheets get wet. We will gladly clean those sheets up. You hit that call bell and let us know. Rarely is that going, I mean, rarely is that going to be an emergent, like, you know, this is like, oh, I have to take care of this immediately or something really bad is going to happen. It's a, okay, let me switch out the IV line and everything and the sheets and it's okay. But let us know, because some people can, out of, you know, not wanting to bother the nurse, which I really appreciate and understand, but some people can connect things to the wrong place and really bad things can happen.
Yeah,
and we don't want that.
You cite that awful example where they connected a IV tube to the oxygen tube or something, or reverse them, and the patient died. And I guess that's a...
Yes, yeah, that stuff has happened, and, you know, it's really totally preventable, and, you know, we understand that people don't want to bother us, but when it's stuff with equipment, we will gladly be bothered, let me tell you.
let's say you, the patient, are in excruciating pain and are giving pain medication. You say it will... generally take maybe up to half an hour before it works, but is it going to take care of all that pain, or is it just going to alleviate a little? I mean, a lot of people expect the pain will just go away. Is that the case?
No, actually, that's a really, really good point. I think a lot of people come in and think if they're having pain, I can give you a shot in your IV and you feel fine. But that's rarely is that the case. It's more about, instead of, I like to say, it's not pain elimination, it's pain management.
Because
to really take away all that pain, most of the time, we're getting to unsafe levels of medication. You know, people can die from having way too many pain medications and, you know, getting to that point where you have absolutely no pain. Those medications are very potent, and we want to use the least amount possible. So, and a lot of times, especially if it's after a surgery, pain is expected, and it's really uncomfortable, and a lot of stuff we do is uncomfortable, and we're going to try and lessen that, but unfortunately, we probably won't be able to take it all away.
Well, this has always been one of my irritants. You've been in the hospital several days after surgery or a procedure or whatever. You want to go home, and your attending physician comes by at 9 a.m. in the morning and lets you know you'll be going home this morning. But you can't just pack up your things and go. And if not, why the delay? It seems like forever before you actually get to leave when the doctor says you can that day.
I wish that it was that simple, because that I see that all the time. Doctor comes in first thing in the morning, you're going to go home this morning.
Yeah.
But for that to happen, so like we were talking about orders earlier, the doctor has to go sit down and look at your chart, say all the things that you need to, you know, what medications we need to get from the pharmacy. Look at all your home medications and say, which ones do I need you to stop taking, continue taking, which ones are new, what kind of education and things like, you know, when can you drive again, when's my follow-up appointment. All that information, the doctor has to sit down and put that information in. Doctor comes to your room and says that to you at 7 a.m., but they don't go sit down at the computer right away and they go see 15 other patients and they don't sit down until 2 p.m., I can't do anything as the nurse until I receive all that information to safely discharge you. So that's why whenever a doctor says, hey, you're going to go home this morning, I quickly chime in.
They should probably say today rather than this morning.
Today, yes, because it's all dependent upon that work that they have to sit down and kind of do.
Yeah.
So I always tell patients, if we can get you out of here, let's plan on eating lunch here with me, and if I can get you out of here earlier than that, wonderful. If not, you won't be, you'll be expecting to go home this afternoon, so...
Well, in your book, you inform us that whenever we're admitted, the hospital is required to ask our code status. What is this, and what are some of the factors that might determine how we answer that?
So that's a really important thing. And when you're going, let's say, in the emergency department, and they say, hey, we're going to admit you to the hospital, you will always be asked, no matter how old you are or what's going on in your life or what disease processes are going on, they're going to say, if your heart stops or you stop breathing, do you want us to perform CPR?
Yeah.
Do you want us to revive you if your heart stops or you stop breathing? And it's really important that we ask that up front. The reason why is because if your heart stops or you stop breathing, you can't answer that question.
Yeah.
And we can't rely on all the people around you. We have to ask you that question when you're of sound mind, at that point. We have to take advantage of that opportunity.
Yeah.
So it's really important that we ask that question, and I really advocate for people knowing the answer to that before they go in. For most people, it's going to say, I want CPR, I want all of that, and that for most of the population, that's going to be what they want. But there are people that are of advanced age or have terminal illnesses or have a lot going on where they don't want that. CPR is pretty traumatic, and we want to know, without a shadow of a doubt, what you want us to do, should that situation occur.
What is a living will, and do you recommend people prepare one before they enter the hospital? And do you have to pay an attorney to complete one, or how do you do that?
Well, so living will basically says, if I become incapacitated, these are the kind of measures I want. Some people want a feeding tube, or some people don't. Some people want a breathing tube, some people don't.
Yeah.
So that says, and it outlines all of that. And it's really helpful because let's say something does happen, you have a stroke like a lot of my patients have had. Your family can go look at this document that you prepared that says, yes, I if this happens, I want a feeding tube, or if this happens, I don't, or something like that. We can refer to that so we know we're following what you wanted.
Yeah.
And I really advocate for people to get those done, out way before they come in the hospital. Talk to your primary care doctor if you have questions about them. You can, a lot of hospitals will help you facilitate getting those put together because it's so important. So if you're admitted or if you're going to your primary care doctor, you can ask about that, and typically they can provide you documentation. The laws about them kind of vary state to state. I believe a lot of states require them to be notarized. So you can, it can be as simple as preparing it, online and printing it off and discussing it with someone and going and getting it notarized and have it, and then giving it to your healthcare facility.
Yeah, that's you also can designate a healthcare power of attorney if you're unable to make decisions or respond. That's should not necessarily, I guess, a close relative, although it may be, I don't know.
Yeah, it can be. So, a lot of people, their health care power of attorney, and that's different from the living will in that it's a person. So the living will says, these are the things I would want or don't want, but the health care power of attorney is a person that can make decisions for you when you're not able to. So that's the difference. But it's really important to identify this person and make sure they know and then you can actually get documentation that legally says this person makes decisions for me. A lot of times it falls to the spouse. Someone would want their spouse, but if they don't want their spouse to make those decisions, or maybe they're separated but not legally divorced, like those kinds of situations, you really want to be able to have that person identified.
Yeah, that's true. Well, what are some of the most important questions to ask as you begin your hospital stay? Have you had a few of those that...
Yes, absolutely. I think the biggest one, the main one, I think, no matter who's coming in your room and what they're talking to you about, is to ask them what their goal for you is.
Oh, I see.
So, the physician, you know, they're going to have a bigger, big picture, more general goal, and they're going to be able to give you very specific answers to questions. But, you know, if you have a physical therapist coming in, what's your goal for me today? You know,
yeah.
Is their goal for you to sit up, or do they really want you to walk up and down the hallway? You know, like those kinds of things. What's their goal for you today? My goal for you is to get up to the chair 3 times today, walk up and down the hallway twice.
Yeah.
And, you know, those kinds of things. Everybody that's coming into the room should have a goal in mind for you, other than, you know, a lot of times the first time they meet you, they're assessing and kind of seeing what they want their goals to be. But after that, they should really know what they want, you know, have a goal in mind. And I think that's really important to understand.
Yeah, that's very good idea to know what everyone's goal for you is. And of course, you should have a goal for yourself, too, in terms of how you feel, and it may not be the same, and you may not be ready to do some of the things you want to do, but to manage as like a co-team between patient and healthcare provider, the team, it really makes a lot of sense to me to talk about goals. Well, let's talk a bit about your brand new book, Admit One, What You Must Know When Going to the Hospital But No One Actually Tells You. And who is this book written specifically for? I guess mostly for patients.
Yeah, I wrote it with the patient in mind. I'll go back to mine. Like the patient who's got admitted with maybe a stroke, and there's, you know, and their loved one is sitting there. You know, a hospital time is hurry up and wait, right?
Yeah.
I wrote that book so that in the in between time can read what's applicable and try to kind of be more prepared for you know, various events that may occur, various procedures, tests, people that may come in the room. But I wrote that originally for patients and their loved ones to help them kind of be more informed. But then I also wrote it for people that are new to healthcare that want to be a part of the healthcare team. So someone who's starting out nursing school, starting out physical therapy school, so they understand the questions that patients have, and maybe it fills in some knowledge gaps that they may have. Because, you know, when I first started nursing school, that was the first time I really had real experience in a hospital. So I didn't know any of that when I started nursing school.
Well, in Section 4, at the end of your book, you include some very helpful pages for note-taking. Please explain the purpose of that.
So, I noticed that a lot of my patients, especially in the ICU, and actually when I didn't work on the ICU, I noticed this as well, people were writing down questions in these, like, notebooks.
Huh.
And everybody kind of had their own notebook, and maybe different family members had their own. But I was like, I want to create, like, this centralized location of information where you can take notes. And then I also wanted to make sure I put in leading questions because, you know, some people aren't question askers. They don't know the questions to ask, even if they might seem obvious. They don't know, and that's okay.
Yeah.
So I wanted to put questions that can kind of get your mind kind of thinking about what kinds of things should I be asking my healthcare providers?
Yeah.
What's realistic for me to ask? So I put those in there as well because I think it's really important to ask those. And then when you get the answers, write the answers down so that you can go through those in the downtime.
You don't want to mess up your book. You can run copies of those pages. Well, where best should we go to preview and purchase your book?
So you can go to nursebooks.org. And you can get a PDF, like an electronic copy, or order a print copy. It's also available on Amazon, although Amazon sold out.
Yeah,
so we're getting more copies.
That they're not currently available, I noticed.
I know. So that's because it's sold out, so we're getting more copies there. So if you want one today, go to nursebooks.org.
Is that nurses.com, isn't it?
I think it's Nurse Books without the S. The American Nurses Association's, publication department.
I think I went to nursesbooks.org to get it.
I'll pull it up right now. Let's see. I think you're right.
Nursesbooks.org.
All right.
I found it right there on the front page. So it's
It's the third one. So it's got the teddy bear on the cover. Can't miss it.
Great cover. Well, in conclusion, whether you're rushed into the hospital through the emergency department or enter through admittance for a routine operation, test, observation, or procedures, a hospital stay can be very traumatic. Disruption of your normal routine, tons of information coming at you from all kinds of people, uncertainty as to outcome, obviously, and stripped down to those awful hospital gowns. Perhaps most important, you feel like you've lost control over your life. Your destiny is totally in someone else's hands. Well, guess what? Your successful healing is a team sport, and along with the doctors and nurses, you are the key, perhaps the key member of the team. And to help ensure you win the game, you need to be informed about what's going on and how you can speed your recovery, and to help you understand who's what, who and what's what during your hospital stay, I highly recommend Katie Cleaver's book, Admit One. And thank you so much, Katie. And if I ever get sick in Charlotte, North Carolina, and have to go to the hospital, I hope you're my nurse.
I hope I am, too.
On the other hand, I'm not sure I want to go to the intensive care unit where you are. So.
Yeah, I don't think you want to do that if you don't have to.
But thanks a million, and best of success in sale of your new book, and I hope you get it restocked on Amazon soon, because I know a lot of people like to go there to buy it.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're into September now, and the carefree days of summer are over. I trust you and your family had a wonderful summer season. Vacation travel to a fun-filled destination the whole family enjoyed. Quality time spent with your kids, even if they are now preteens or teenagers. I trust you and they still enjoy your time together. Visits with out-of-town relatives and friends you only see maybe once or twice a year, maybe not even that much. Fun-filled weekends and outdoor activities. Like a lot of us in the summertime, do you find yourself much more calm, relaxed, living in the present, and enjoying every moment, putting off all those stressful decisions until after Labor Day? In effect, a positive, stress-free summertime perspective on life. Well, guess what? Labor Day is here and gone. It's autumn. Are there steps you and I can take to prevent that annual letdown in the fall and the return to the good old pressure cooker? Well, obviously, each one of us faces our own unique life challenges and circumstances, and one size does not fit all. But here are a few quick suggestions. First, who says you have to abandon your relaxed summertime perspective on life simply because we are now into fall? After all, you weren't free of all work obligations all summer long. Even if you had a full month's vacation, you still were on the job two-thirds of the summer. And while at work, maybe you were more relaxed because inside your heart and mind, you were told to ease off a bit and not take things so seriously. Away from work, your responsibilities as spouse and parent certainly were not less in the summer when your kids were home from school and perhaps your spouse was off from his or her job. And obviously you spent more together, so you had more responsibility to have good times, but they seemed easier to do, didn't it? The difference was your summer mindset told you to enjoy those interactions. I don't know why you can only do that in the summer. Can't your heart and mind encourage you to do the same this fall? Second, you have a great deal of control over just how hectic your schedule becomes this fall. On the job, take the initiative to prioritize your workday, seek new projects that fit your talents and make you feel good. Ask your boss for redesign, even relief from performing those same old repetitive functions that you so abhor. And if you're the boss, assign those functions to someone else. Develop a circle of cooperation relationships with colleagues that will ease your burden through specialization and combining of talents. And away from the job, there is no harm in saying no to some of those volunteer and social responsibilities that fill up so much of your weeknights and weekends and rob you of relaxation and family time. Stick only with those that you both enjoy and where you can make a real difference. And third, a lot of those quality family time activities you had this summer needn't go away just because it's fall. here's a good idea. Insist on at minimum 3 family meals a week where no one, including you, Mom and Dad, is excused, and absolutely no smartphones or iPads at the table, and no eating in front of TV. It's to share experiences, parent and child, each one, to have a turn to share with all the others. And keep proposing shared parent-son or parent-daughter sports and recreation activities that you so enjoyed this summer. They may need to change with the season, but they needn't go away. And remember the 10-minute-a-day commitment that a recent guest, Terry Orbuck, the love doctor, suggested. That means spend at least 10 minutes a day in freelance communication with your spouse or significant other on a topic totally unrelated to shared parenting or household duties or household finances, any of those kind of gruesome things you talk about all the time. Just relax and get to really know and enjoy your spouse all over again. And here's a fourth suggestion. Design and implement realistic personal action plans that can help you retain and expand upon your summertime perspective all year long. Plan out long family weekends. You can take those at times other than the summer. And extended travel, maybe for business, for pleasure, or combine the two by bringing your spouse along on your next business trip. I've done that a few times, and it's been great. Remain physically active throughout the year. There's no reason you need to be a couch potato in the fall, winter, or spring. Exercise at least 60 minutes 5 times a week and make it a fun exercise, something you like to do, and ideally join up with your spouse or buddies in exercising. That's a great way to do it. Heck, around late October, you may need to move indoors, but if so, join the Y or an exercise club. And begin a new activity with your husband or wife, something both of you would like to try. Oh, dance lessons, drama, whatever it might be. And positively insist upon remaining active, informed, and involved in your preteen and teenagers' lives. Go to their school sporting events, concerts, and plays. Even if you can't sit with them, you can cheer them on, share the experience, and can reminisce together after the event. And fifth and finally, step up and make plans to meet those decisions and challenges that you've been putting off all summer. The only way to put them behind you is to face them head on with you in control. The bottom line, for most of us, it's all too easy to get stuck in a rut, repeating the same old routine day after day, even though we know it's not a routine that we relish. A great way to start the fall, pick one small change you want to make in your life, develop an action plan, and accomplish that change, or that will accomplish that change, and keep at it for at least the next 3 to 4 weeks. And as you make progress, do you notice a positive change coming about in your overall attitude, your daily emotions, your expectations for the future? Because once you attack and successfully accomplish small changes, you can then move on to bigger challenges later. And most importantly, you are beginning to feel more alive, happy, positively engaged, and in control. And what more can you ask? Enthusiastic like in summer, but this time for all year long. You know, another description of this is midlife renewal. And for help on your journey to the brighter today and tomorrow, I invite you to preview my book, A Midlife Challenge Wake Up by Roy C. Richards. It offers a comprehensive journey through 18 chapters and 21 self-help exercises that guide you to first design, then accomplish the joyful and productive life that you so richly deserve. And to preview and purchase my book, you can go to Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com or to our website, MiddleAgeRenewal.com. And on our website, you can also find a comprehensive store that contains some of the best self-help, guidance, and motivational books, both from prior outstanding guests that we've had on the program, along with some of the all-time greats like Dale Carnegie's one, for instance. And it's all in one place. 5 different categories: personal renewal, business leadership and career, marriage and parenting, exercise and nutrition. Obviously, they're important for a renewed and happy life. And finally, spiritual connection. You simply click on the store tab on our website, middleagerenewal.com, and you can have a good time just previewing those books, because they give you little snapshots of each one to tell you what it's all about, and you can learn a lot just from those snapshots. And that's our program for today. Tune in next week when our two guests will reveal unique ways to save, invest, and accumulate assets for the retirement of your dreams. Some unique ways other than just the stock market, like so many of us are wrapped up in. And speak with you then on Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.